Ladies and gentlemen, good morning. Welcome back to Adherence First and 15 by our association, Associazione. Today, our guest is going to be Dr. Jacopo Dallan, who is mainly involved in amazing activities in skull-based surgery and ENT. His topics today, he's going to talk about some of the new approaches through our corridors, such as the eye, to the skull base, but using the eye as a corridor. Jacopo Dallan is a renowned surgeon, also involved in some research, and he's one of the contributor and writer of the an amazing book about the surgical anatomy of the internal carotid artery with Professor Castelnuovo and Manfred Chabisha. Good morning, Dr. Dallan.
Good morning.
Thank you so much. I'm really glad about your participation to our activities. This is the first time that we are going to talk about the eye as for some pathologies, but not only pathologies, but also as a corridor. The topic of today is going to be briefly summarized in a few steps, and he will describe and show some presentation and videos. So we briefly introduced you, and would you like to please start your presentation?
Thank you so much, of course. Thank you to everyone. It's a little bit strange just to have a talk in this way, but I think that it's future, and we have to start to imagine that there are several ways to communicate. So I feel that it's a great occasion, and I think that Dr. Puja Degani has a great merit to push this this kind of activity. So I would say that thank you for involving me there in this project, and thanks for giving me the opportunity to talk about this kind of approach, I would say, this kind of idea. And I would say that it's not a complete an idea of mine. I have discussed with the other surgeons. So I think that it's not more the time to think to a one-man show, but to start think really in a way in which all of us put something just to create some bigger and some beautiful. The idea to use the orbit like a corridor, it's not a new idea. It has been used in the past. And talking about transorbital approach, it's by far a very huge argument. So in order to go to the essential and not to talk a lot and not to be too complex, to be listened, to be followed, I think that it's better to reduce the argument to I would say a part of the topic. In this respect, my talk will be on the superior lead approach, that is one of the approaches we can use through the orbit. And the target point is, in this case, limited to the middle cranial fossa. I try, and I hope at the end of the discussion, some good points will be outlined. And it's time to go. It's time to go because I started in the lab of Manfred Chabisha in 2008. So 11 years ago, and the picture you see are the first picture I saw passing through I would say superior lead approach. It's a right side orbit, and it was the first time for me that I had the opportunity to look transorbitally endoscopic assisted to the superior orbital fissure, to the orbital roof, and to the tentorium when I was inside. So I was completely in a new field, in a new anatomic area with a strange perspective. So 2008. And in this case, this was the first case I saw that make me think, okay, you can do it. It was 2011. The patient was not operated by myself, was not operated via a transorbital approach, but it was the first time I realized that the orbit could be a corridor to get such a deeper area. It was 8 years ago. It was absolutely outside of my technical possibilities, but something in my mind was, okay, I think that it could be done. And I really had no idea if it was possible or not. But these two days, 2008 and 2011, was really significant for me. And if of course, you consider that Albert Einstein said that if at first, in the beginning, any idea, any given idea is not absurd, it's not crazy, then there is no hope for it. I mean, that is perfectly fitting with this concept, because if you think 11 years ago to start looking at the orbit, in, I would say, in a very curious way, but it was the period or the transnasal extended approaches, and changing perspective was strange. So it was my story. Since that, things have changed. Many people in the world have proposed something about the orbit, something about the idea of the orbit like a target area and like a corridor. That is our philosophy now in these lessons. And this person married part of the of the efforts, and merit all my gratitude, because as I told you, it's not a work of one person. It's a way in which we discuss. I would say that every good idea is the fusion of different perspective and discussing. So Professor Castelnuovo, Franceschini, Locatelli from Varese, where people with which I discuss the idea, the possibility, and every one of that of this person is absolutely part, an important, fundamental, critical part of this idea. So it's not a idea of one person, it's idea that come from other person that fuse myself, Castelnuovo, Franceschini, and of course people from other part of the world. Fix the point and try to be clear as possible. I would say transorbital surgery, I would say orbit as a corridor. That means sparing the periorbit. That means creating a corridor, a way to get deeper area. Because of course, as your experience, as your patients become more and more complex, as the pathology are multi-compartmental, of course, one way is not enough. And pushing the limit of a single approach, I think it's really wrong, because you adapt the pathology, the patient problems, to your ability. So I'm really grateful for the great opportunity I have to work with different specialists from different areas. That makes me be really open-minded. And I do not believe the nose is the answer. I do not believe the eye is the answer. I do not believe there is no one. I don't want to say any dogmatic word. So not to be dogmatic in any way, the orbit is a great opportunity. The nose is a great opportunity. The oral cavity is a great opportunity. So should you be scared about this? Is if my second daughter was not afraid to, without any teeth, to go against a very big piece of bread, I said, okay, I can go. And these are the opportunities, but this is your feeling. You see a lot of things, you say, I cannot do it. You can do it. You have to learn one step. So before start running, you have to become able to walk. So just to learn one thing, just to adapt the thing to your necessity and go on with your growing experience. So don't rely to people that try to scare you about one approach or the other. Be serious, but consider that you can learn as I learn, and you can improve like I am improving in my personal activities. So the concept is that whenever you are dealing with a superior lead approach, you have to learn just 2 points, that there is the orbicularis oculi muscle and that there is the orbital rim. Once you are in the undersurface of the orbicularis oculi muscle, you can get the orbital rim and create your corridor, just like you see in this, I would say, small summary. So you make the incision here, you found the orbicularis oculi muscle, then you found the superlateral part of the orbital rim, and in this way you spare the levator palpebrae muscle. I mean, you have completely spared the function of the superior iliad. That means that you can get enough space to work in a corridor between the bone and the periorbit. So, summarize to the essential. This is a sagittal portion of a superior iliad. You see the orbicularis oculi muscle here. You see the orbital rim here, just over there. This is the tarsus. This is the system of the levator palpebrae. This is what you need to spare. It is difficult. No. Find that muscle is by far more easy in vivo situation than in a cadaveric dissection. So don't be, I would say, disappointed when you start in the lab and you don't see very well the orbicularis oculi muscle. It's by far more easy in the clinical scenario. So get the undersurface of the muscle, stay on the undersurface of this flap, get the bone, and create your corridor. Believe me, these are the only two points that you fix in your mind. And in this case, you can see how it is quite easy to find a straight way to the middle cranial fossa. So it is the perfect solution for everything? Of course, no. It's an option. And the real interesting part is that the dissection of the periorbital fascial layer, the periorbita, the periosteum, call as you want, the concept is still the same, found the superolateral part of the orbital rim. So no matter the way you prefer a lead crease incision, a lateral cant, I don't want to discuss about these are details. The concept is find the bone, sparing the levator palpebrae, create your corridor to the lateral part, the bony lateral part of the orbit. You can see here it's a drawing showing the GWS. Of course, is the greater ring of the sphenoid. You see the inferior orbit create just like a triangle that makes you clearly visible the open door to the middle cranial fossa, to the cavernous sinus, the inferior orbital fish structure. So this is the topic and the target. Of course, the target are, if you want to go to the anterior cranial fossa, but it's not the item of this discussion, you see that you can control the undersurface of the lateral part of the frontal lobe. But Given the fact that we are dealing in this lesson with the middle cranial fossa approach, so the region of the temporal lobe, the region of the lateral lobe of the cavernous sinus, the Meckel's cave region, you see in the red dot circle, the approach or the target of the approach. So just to make you see what I had the opportunity, that video is coming from the lab of Barcelona from 2012. So it's a 7 years old video, and I put because it's part of my story. And you can see orbit. You have the superior orbital fissure just over there. The middle cranial fossa could be completely exposed, And it's an in vivo situation, is a cadaveric dissection, and the black arrow is pointing a very important structure that I will show you later, that is the meningoorbital band. But as I told you, too much words can be confusing. So fix your point in the palpebral work and the point related to the bony part, find your superior and inferior orbital fissure, and then go on with the work. So again, like Latin said, repetita juvant, you see it's a left side, so the MCFD is a middle cranial fossa dura, as the floor of the middle cranial fossa. You see the temporalis muscle, the inner surface of the temporalis muscle just over there, and this is our target to go to the middle cranial fossa. So again, you see in the anterior cranial fossa here, you see in a middle cranial fossa here, and if you drill down and expose the middle fossa floor here, you can see exactly the petrous apex, the V3 coming down from the foramen ovale, but these details are probably too much, and I want to focus the point to the middle cranial fossa approach, that is this kind of approach. So again, left side here, so the meningoorbital band here, it's the superior orbital fissure just over there, you see an intradural vision of the this kind of approach in a cadaver. The TL is for temporal lobe, it's LWCS, it's the lateral wall of the cavernous sinus. But have a look in this part, so have a look to, you see my pointer? Okay, so the red circle, the red ellipse is going in an intradural exploration. The black is pointing out what is called an interdural exploration, interdural dissection of the lateral wall of the cavernous sinus. That is an atypical approach that the interdural space neurosurgeon do passing laterally. In this case, the position of the meningoorbital band make the dissection of the two layers of the dura, of the cavernous sinus, much easier and probably very useful for selected approach to the lateral wall and the Meckel's cave. So reducing the amount of information and trying to point and repeat the same concept back to the essential. So have a look to the approach. No matter the way, bigger or smaller, you create your approach, you see the orbicularis oculi muscle, found the undersurface, reach the bone, and then create your corridor, detaching the periorbita from the inner surface of the bone. So second step, so simplify to the essential. Second step, identification of the bony landmarks, that means superior orbital fissure, that means inferior orbital fissure, and have a look, it's a cadaveric dissection, superior and inferior orbital fissure, the lateral wall here is a right side, here is a left side in the in vivo situation, but the story doesn't change because the concepts are still the same. So have a look in the dissection on the cadaver, SOF is superior orbital fissure, the approach for a middle cranial fossa here and here, the greater ring of the sphenoid, the orbital part of the greater ring of the sphenoid represent your gateway. So superior orbital fissure, inferior orbital fissure, temporalis muscle, they create a triangle. You pass through this triangle and get the middle cranial fossa. Just to summarize, again, Manfred Schaffischer taught me that there is only one anatomy, and there are different ways to look at the anatomy. So I want to offer you what I learned from this maestro. That means that try to fuse in your mind a 3D understanding. And in this case, this is a right orbit here, greater ring of the sphenoid, expose the bone, drill the bone, expose the dura, and then have a look at what is behind. This is the first step, but I'm sure that it's something that you can do in a very easy way. It's by far more easy, and believe me or not, it's true, to dissect this kind of surgery than dissecting a lot of transnasal approaches. But of course, as in any other situation, you start, you have maybe an idea, and then you become more and more curious. You become more and more interested, and you talk with your friends, and they say it seems to be crazy or not to go on. So other people went on with a different idea, and it was a moment I said, okay, why not to go to the lateral wall? I remember a lot of discussion with my neurosurgical colleagues about the interdural approach on the lateral wall of the cavernous sinus. This is an endoscopic assisted transorbital dissection of the two layers of the lateral wall of the cavernous sinus, or go to the ciliary fissure. So it is like a pterional approach, I don't know. But the area with which we are dealing, passing through the orbit, it's by far similar to the area that the pterional or mini pterional approach is not my topic. It's a field for neurosurgeon. I think that we all work together and not one against the other. So I do feel that it is an opportunity, that it's nice that, thanks again, Pooja, for your work, because it's nice to share the idea, even if, and the story is going on, and probably as much as people work together, things go better. So, of course, you gain practical experience, your skill becomes better, you feel more comfortable and start to manage the lesser wing of the sphenoid, that in the beginning it's a little bit more complex, to go medially to manage the anterior clinoid process. And so you are moving medially. So in the beginning you are afraid of opening the dura, like in any other situation. But you realize that with your experience, consider that the first case is date far 2012. So I would say it's a long story. It's a 7 years old for me, and I do feel that since that things are really changed, and now there are several groups that are using this. And in this video, it's a 5-6 years old video. We take down the lesser ring. We were in the anterior clinoid process, in an extradural anterior approach to the anterior clinoid process, more or less here. And of course, we can do better. It's normal. We should do better. We have to do better. But if you think that it was a 5-6 years ago surgery, quite a complete extradural anterior clinoidectomy. So that means that you have resected lesser ring, greater ring. So It's an interesting point of view. And as I told you, it's an interesting point of view because, as I told you in the beginning, it's not a work of one person alone. So again, thanks to Franceschini, that was my former chief, Castelnuovo and Locatelli, because this idea has been discussed a lot. And my speech is, I think I would say that is a speech on behalf of all these persons that gave a critical enthusiasm, a critical improvement to this idea. Everyone has put something in this pocket. So go inside and have a look what is the midocranial fossa. So the dura of the right side, it was one of the first time we saw the dura, so now it seems to be, I would say, normal, but in that moment was not the same. So think to do the first, for the first time something, and to see, you know that there is something behind, but whenever you see the temporal lobe from the orbit, it's not like, the story, this is the lateral wall of the cavernous sinus, and all these is the lateral wall of the cavernous sinus, and all these venous bridge and vein are huge. And so it's, and it was a meningioma surgery. We did, I think, a good job, but we can discuss later about the indication.
I'm sorry, Jacopo. I just wanna have a question. You exactly say that when you're inside, and if you're one of the first one to try this kind of approach, you don't know exactly what is in front of you. Okay, so how was the feeling, and how was what are you expecting when you're opening the dura, and you know, I mean, in a quite expanded horizon, you know what is after the dura, but what is in front of you, and suddenly what's happening when you open the dura in that part?
Good question. The answer is that, of course, you know what is behind. You have done several dissection, and so you know what is behind. But one thing is knowing, and one thing is doing. So it's the question is, the story is well explained about the feeling you have, because you know that, okay, you think you are prepared to go there because you truly believe that is a right option for the patient. And based on the grounds we have now, I can say that it was really a good choice. But the first time I opened the dura, it was 2014, the first case 2012, the first kind I opened the dura and I saw the temporal lobe was 2014. And of course, I can tell you that you are expecting something, and thanks God everything was okay. But the feeling was, we were absolutely excited, and I would say scared. And of course, gaining experience allows you to be more calm and confident. But in the story of every one of us, there is a moment, there is a momentum in which you decide to go through the border. And we were prepared, because this story is not born without base, solid grounds. But I say that it was excited. So, but the story is not finished, because going inside, this was the paper I published 2 years ago about the transorbit approach to the lateral wall of the cavernous sinus. But the nice part, you see, these are cadaveric 2012 and 2014. So there are 2 years between the lab and the surgical application. But you see the lateral wall of the cavernous sinus, you see this venous bridging vein here, venous bridging system here. It is the same bridging system, connection vein, call as you want, between the temporal lobe and the lateral lobe of the cavernous sinus. It's a left side, left side, left side, left side. That means that you are expecting to find this because you have been there in the lab. But looking and seeing this in the in vivo situation, it's not the same, but it's part of the story. And you were here. So the idea were clear. We discussed a lot with the other parts of the group. Again, do not consider this as a lesson of Jacopo Dallan alone, but it's a lesson of the group. And after that, you have to close, but differently to a transnasal approach. You have the orbit that makes like a support. So the risk of a CSF leak from the orbital incision, it's by far less important. So a multi-layer, no matter the way, Duragen or fascia, fat, I don't want to discuss about details. Have a look to the drawing I prepared. You create your opening, you put fat, you put fascia, and again fat, but the story can change. You can use different materials. I do feel that the role of the orbital content in supporting, in pushing your reconstruction makes your reconstruction by far more solid than a typical transnasal approach in which below your reconstruction you have nothing, you have air. So the story regarding the topic of the reconstruction is very, very different from a transorbital approach in respect to a pure transnasal approach. I don't want to spend too much time to the inferior extension, but just to show you that this is a right side, this is the temporal lobe here, and you can see here that you can go by far more posterior and see V3 coming out from the foramen ovale. So passing through the orbit, you can drill down all the floor of the middle cranial fossa and see the third branch of the trigeminal nerve passing from the foramen ovale. Again, thanks to Manfred Schabischer, because the anatomy is still the same, really the same. So no matter the way you are dealing with a transnasal approach, an infratemporal approach, fish or whatsoever, or a transorbital approach, the structures are there. You have only to know that they are there and you have to find them. The navigation is by far necessary. I don't want to discuss about other details. So how we do it? This is the story. So fix the point, palpable work, 2 points, orbicularis oculi muscle and orbital rim. Second point, dissect your periorbital from the inner surface of the bone. All my words can be summarized in this. Find the superior and inferior orbital fissure. And how you do it, how we do it, like in any other skull-based extended approach, 2-3 surgeons together, so working bimanually, it's a preferred option. In my hands, I prefer to work with my 2 hands together. But as you can see, you can share and you should share your surgery with your colleague. You can work with the endoscope. You can work with the microscope. So no dogma, never, never be dogmatic. So thinking in only one way, it's always a limit. So this picture are taken from a case, a very extended case we did, and we decide why not to use the opportunity to work with 2 hands with the microscope, with 2 hands with the endoscope. This is my neurosurgeon. I would say that you can share your part of the surgery. In this case, I hold the endoscope. Other part of the surgery, I did the surgery. So consider this surgery like a team surgery. Stop, think to a one-man show. Back to some cases. I don't want to steal your time. The concept is that these are the first days. This case I did in Barcelona. This was one of the cases I did with my former chief. And if you have a look, I will skip the video because I feel that the video can add few information. I will show you some few part of the video because the story is more or less the same you see before, But the interesting part of this story is have a look to the post-op CT scan, and I will show you MRI. Have a look to the tumor that is completely invading the greater ring and the lesser ring, completely pushing the superior orbital fissure and the meningeal orbital band. And if you look at the post-op, you see exactly like we did, quite a complete anterior extradural, complete, I would say, clinoidectomy. So it's a typical neurosurgical procedure done transcranially, lateral, with a lateral approach. Is a very important approach for the management of this area, and the possibility to manage in this case extradurally, but there is no reason we can go intradurally, allows you to create a very huge working corridor for different pathologies. And combination of the nose, look at this case. So pathology in the middle fossa, pathology in the sphenoid area. It was a case I did with Castelnuovo, a great case we did together. But regarding or regardless the video, what is interesting is that you can gain a very good resection. And you have to consider that these cases are the first cases. I prefer to show you the case, the first cases we did, because I do feel that with growing experience, with the increasing amount of data we had now, we can really talk differently about this approach. This is something that I think that it's time quite to skip, but I want to fix some points more. It's time to collect data. Probably yes. We published in Neurosurgery this paper regarding sphenoorbital meningioma, but I'm really proud that there are several other groups that have started to use this approach and to expand what we started. What I want to say, that this was a case I did. It was the first time we go inside of the temporal lobe. I will skip the video because it adds nothing, but I will show you the patient. The results was not perfect, but gives you the idea on how deep you can fire inside of the temporal lobe, reaching the petrous apex and exposing the lateral wall of the cavernous sinus. The patient is in this case, so you have great opportunity. But I'm really proud to tell you that, to show that in literature are coming several groups, especially one from South Korea, but the group of New York from Till Schwartz is... it's absolutely working on this topic. And if you look at the paper they published and all other papers that are coming out, you see that they present at least 20 cases of Meckel's cave lesion. Have a look to this trigeminal schwannoma done completely transorbit. So I'm really, really proud. And I think that... Dusik is a friend. All the group from South Korea has really pushed the border, and they have done a step forward. And they have show. I had the idea that we can do this, but they did, and I'm really happy to show the results. And I think that next time you should invite also Dusik Kong from South Korea. Because I do believe that all together, and this story perfectly fits with this concept, all together we can do better than ourselves alone. So you can find a lot of publication from this. And so from the first idea from the first case in 2012. Now you can find, I have no personally have done yet a case in the Meckel's cave passing through the orbit, passing through the nose, yes, but not through the orbit. But the result from the South Korea group are absolutely outstanding, and they merit really my personal thank, because I do believe they have done great job. What about the cosmetic results? They are great. The lead crease approach is absolutely nice. The scar is quite invisible. Everything is fine? No, everything is not fine. Things can happen, and you can have bleeding, very bad bleeding. I mean, you know that whenever you are facing with this kind of new approach, you can have problems. You can have problems intradurally. You can have problems in the approach. The first case you see here, it was really a huge bleeding. I had this unfortunate situation with Castelnuovo. I was exhausted at the end of this. So just to tell you that not everything is fine, and things happen, and you should be ready to face this. You should work in a team, because you cannot manage everything by yourself. So I think that you asked me before how you feel when you open the door. You can have a problem, and you should be ready to face the problem, because in this case, you see, anyway, we managed, but the story is that something can happen. Something can happen outside the dura, something can happen inside of the dura, like in this case, and it is not always a nice situation. The patient has no problem, but this was an intradural bleeding, as you can see here. The patient has no problem at all, but just to show that we really be serious, honest, critic with our service, present data seriously, and if an idea is working well, the idea will not remain confined to your hands, but will be used by other hands. And the impression I have now is that transorbital approach, especially for middle cranial fossa, for Meckel's cave, for lateral wall of the cavernous sinus, for probably the petrous apex, is really a great opportunity. I've discussed with several friends, with Matteo. It's a great opportunity that and my topic is relating on this. I hope I've done I've been enough clear, because I do feel that it's a great opportunity, and if after this lesson someone start and push the limit and put his data, her data on this, this lesson has been useful. What about CSF leak? No CSF leak. I have done big hole, but the orbit is absolutely a great support for your reconstruction. So don't be afraid about CSF leak. Don't be afraid about the orbit, because if you spare the periorbit, you push really few to the orbital content. Anyway, you can stop your surgery every 20, 30 minutes and relax the orbit. But if you resect the bone, it's the same story on any skull-based approach. Resect the bone and leave the tissue. So limitations. I don't want to talk about limitation. I think it's time to finish, because the limitation is something that there is always a limitation. If you fall in love with the transorbital approach, you have a problem. It's an opportunity. So learn to combine multi-party compartmental lesions. Call for multi-portal approach. No dogma, no dogma, never. The endoscope is not against the microscope. The transnasal approach is not against the transorbital approach. The transoral approach is another great opportunity, but there are other opportunities. So my point of reflection, of discussion, is that no dogma. We are in a, I would say, in a newborn period, but probably the newborn period is past, is over. Now probably we are quite in a preschooler period, and the data start to come, thanks to the work of the South Korea group, to DUSICOM. We are now the clear understanding that we can go. I went in the cavernous sinus and in the Meckel's cave in the lab. They went in the surgical scenario, and they did great. So we know that we can do this, and so it's a great opportunity. So modulate your approach. So never be dogmatic. Thank to all these guys, Casanova, but all my residents, and for sure there is a long way, but I think that it's time to finish this presentation. I hope it was clear enough. Thanks, Pooja, again for your invitation. I've been really impressed from your enthusiasm.
We would like to congratulate you for the amazing talk and the cases. We met each other many years ago. The first one was during my period with Castelnuovo, and Jacopo was actually doing the combined approach. We were recording, you were performing the combined approach, transoral and transnasally, for a few different pathologies. And after that, he published one of the research. We do have it's time for some questions. We do have few of them, many actually. We have different accounts connected, so I have to just pick up the good ones. And we do have one question from Napoli. I cannot tell you where. It's one of our friends. And obviously, he's asking me a good question. And what about medical legal aspects? In that field, he's asking who is in charge for the recovery? Like who? I guess that he was actually asking the question: who is in charge for that? The neurosurgeon, the ophthalmologist, or the ENT surgeon?
In Italy, we do not have. The question is perfect, and if it is coming from Naples, is for sure a great friend. I don't know who, but it's a great friend. But the question is again, is perfect. But I have no clear answer. I mean, in Italy, we do not have a specialist like I go often in the Netherlands, like they have in Netherlands for the ophthalmoplastic surgeon or the orbital surgeon. So no one is in charge, or everyone is in charge. So the concept is that if we are a team, and we decide to go through this way, the responsibility is of the team. So it's, of course, you can try to call your ophthalmologist, but most of the time in Italy, you do not have a great interest in this. Having said that, one of the most important part is a clear discussion with the patient, but we are not talking about a common cold. In this case, we are talking about a critical pathology with important implications and with a natural history. So regardless the way, going in the Meckel's cave or in the greater ring of the sphenoids could be dangerous for the patients, regardless the approach. So I do feel that if we are a team, the responsibility is of the team. Probably one of the surgeons is in charge of the approach, but as the team grows, this differentiation, this division is becoming less evident. So you do one part and the other guy do the other, but you can change their role are interchangeable. There you can manage different parts of surgery. So dealing with such complex disease is absolutely something that is complex, and complication are can be expected. It is not possible to think not to have problems or complication in this kind of surgery. It's not possible. Professor Draff said, and we all need to thank him for his words, that the only one that has no complication is the one that does not operate. So I feel that considering the pathology, the natural history of the pathology, if you have a growing sphenoid wing meningioma going to the optic canal, the patient has a natural history of suffering of the vision. So we have really clear discuss about this. But I do feel that all the team, the several doctors involved, are responsible for that.
Sure. It's time for the two questions. The second one, which I know exactly what he's talking about, is from Emirates, and he's asking us, what are you using for displacing the orbit? This is a good question, because you explained that very well, not in this topic, but in the lab last time. Would you please explain what are you using for displacing that?
Normally, we use a retractor, the malleable retractor that can use with or not, it's up to you, with a silastic sheath in order to cover and protect the periorbita. So whenever we are dealing with a periorbital sparing approach, the concept is that sparing the periorbita allows you not to have fat inside of your surgical field, and a malleable retractor is enough to take your orbital content away from your instrument. Consider the fact that the approach is gained inside of the bone of the greater ring of the sphenoid. So, as a matter of fact, the pressure on the orbital content is really limited, because you are not pushing the orbital content from its natural position. You are simply creating space lateral to the orbital content. So the story, I know that it seems to be scaring, but the story is in this way. You are not displacing your orbital content from the natural position. You are gaining space, removing bone. That means that at the end of surgery, if you have not managed and damaged too much the periorbita, the appearance of the eye is, I don't want to say perfect, but do not imagine to have just like a panda eye or something like this. That means that a simple retractor ordered by the assistant, in this way you can decide to stop every 30 minutes. I don't want to say do 10 hours surgery without removing your retractor, but it's a little bit easy, much more than people think, to manage the orbital content away from the instrument.
Great. So you actually already answered to the other question, and that was exactly how's the eyeball appearance after surgery and before surgery, and you completely answered to that question.
It depends on how you damage the periorbita.
Exactly.
The real noble part of this situation is the orbital content. Whenever you do not transgress the periorbita, believe me, the orbita appearance after surgery is not, I don't want to say perfect, but you don't have to think to any traumatic situation. If you go inside, the disease is inside of the periorbita, things change dramatically. Completely a different story. But in a periorbita sparing approach, the appearance of the orbit is, I would say, good enough, and I would advise to have a look to the pupilla, to the eye, sometimes during surgery. If you have a good relationship with an ophthalmologist, take this guy with you because it's perfect. But it's not so easy to have this kind of nice collaboration. I would say that I'm lucky enough, but I really believe that we need a stronger collaboration with ophthalmologists, neurosurgeon, maxillofacial surgeon, and so on, a radiologist.
This is also, I think that the periorbit sparing thing is very good also, because if you are avoiding any involvement of the muscle. So they are asking me, what about the movement? And actually you already answered to the question, because you are sparing the periorbit. So that means that no muscular activity will be affected. So this
Absolutely not. The real risk, if we want to be completely clear, but too much details, I think, for a lesson, but the real risk you have in this kind of approach is a risk related to the vascularization of the central retinal artery that in some case can be related to the branches of the middle meningeal artery. There is a connection passing to the greater, you see my picture? See my picture again? Yeah. Okay, I want to show one thing that it's the explanation of my words now. And I think it's the really most important things in this story. Maybe it was in the beginning. Okay, we are close to the okay, have a look at this.
Yes.
This black arrow show you, this is a superior orbital fissure, it's the right side, it's the greater ring of the sphenoid. This is a recurrent arterial vessel connecting the intraorbital system, mostly the lacrimal artery, but not only, with the middle meningeal artery. In some situation, this artery is the main feeder of the central retinal artery. This is well known from the angiographic literature. And this is a possible explanation of a severe damage of the visual activity in this patient related to the fact that performing the approach and drilling down this and managing this connecting arterial branch, recurrent lacrimal artery whatsoever, this foramen is called Hirtle foramen, is present in more or less 60% of the cases, but these details are meaningless. The real concept is that if you damage this artery and you are unlucky and you have no chance to know this pre-op, and you are unlucky, the patient can wake up with a severe damage of his or her visual activity, because this branch could be, and we don't know in which patient, could be the main feeder of the central retinal artery. That is the terminal branch of the optic nerve. That means if you damage this, you go to a complete or partial morosis or a severe visual impairment. This is the real problem we have. Based on the data acquired here in Pisa, not only for this kind of approach, but also for Graves' disease, I can tell you that it's really an uncommon situation. So you have not to be afraid about this. But the problem of the muscle, of the damage of the muscle, is, I would say, simply not existing, because you spare the periorbita, the muscle, the remain covered and repaired by any injury. The real limit is that in a very unknown percentage of case, the damage of this vessel, this connection between the external and internal carotid system, can result in a severe damage to the vision of the patient. I don't hear you.
I'm sorry. I was muting because of to let you more clear. I think that you covered the whole complication, the whole anatomy, the critical point, the tips and pitfalls for such surgery. We don't have many colleagues right now. Unfortunately, we have to conclude this topic. I would like also to have a few different specialists around the world connected for a ground rounds about this topic. I will for sure invite.
Would be great.
Yes, I would like to create such a spider between different colleagues with the team from also from South Korea, from Korea, and we will discuss more about that. Oh, we basically right now have Dr. Janigaram live connected, video connected. I'm sorry for that because he was part previously of some topics, so he can be able to attend also the video.
Master.
Unfortunately, Dr. Janakiram, we have to conclude the topic. For all the attendees, the next lesson will be probably scheduled for Professor Agaki from the IAKI. Unfortunately, she wasn't able to attend previously, but we will try to do our best to make her attend the next one. However, I would like to express my gratitude to Jacopo for this amazing talk. The next appointment is set up for the 15th of April of this month, once again with our adherent First and 15, and the next topic is going to be with the Dr. Sampath Chandra Prasad Rao from India, and he will talk about some internal carotid arteries anatomy from a lateral point of view, not only from the frontal. Thank you again, Jacopo, for attending this adherent First and 15, and I would like to express my gratitude from the association ASSASAN.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Which you are part of it right now, actually. Thank you again, and see you on 15th of April.
Bye-bye.